Hey there, Danny with Right Foot Down. I messed up this ad read so many times because I really want to tell you about Track Monkey Apparel. They make great quality, enthusiast shirts along with hats, stickers, watches, patches, you name it. A couple of my personal favorites are their Life is Better at the Track tee and their One Track Mind tee. You should really check them out and see for yourself. Their products are great for you or the gearhead in your life. Visit trackmonkeyapparel.com.
You're listening to the Untitled Car Show in partnership with RightFootDown.com. Visit RightFootDown for your daily automotive fix. If you enjoyed today's program, please tell a friend. It's the best way to support this show. If you want to visit the archives, go to YouTube and search for Untitled Car Show. That'll bring you to the archived episodes. If you want to follow the show, just search for Untitled Car Show on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can always send an email to the show at untitledcarshow@rightfootdown.com. We're so glad you decided to spend the next hour or so with us. Without further ado, let's get into today's program. Hey, before we get into today's program, just a bit of a heads up. There were some audio glitches, some recording issues. Ed was an absolute delight to put up with everything that happened in the evening. So I want to give him a special, thanks again for, putting up with the technical issues, the glitches, and for sticking around maybe a little bit later than he intended to. He's an absolutely fantastic individual. And after you listen to today's show, make sure you go check out everything on VinWiki. And without further ado, let's get into today's program. Hello, welcome to Untitled Car Show. I'm your host, Ike. Today we are joined by a connoisseur in the car world. I guess the best way to describe him might be a classic gentleman in the car sense. It's Ed Bullion. You've owned classic or exotic car dealerships. You currently hold Cannonball Records. Just an all-around fascinated individual in the automotive space. There's not much I think that you haven't done or seen in this space, and you're just a very fascinating man. And of course, he is the founder and runner, I guess, CEO of VinWiki, which is a wonderful automotive YouTube channel and website that you need to go get yourself signed up for. Ed, how are you doing this evening?
I'm great. That's all very kind of you to say. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no, it's an absolute delight. So let's kind of just get into this because I find it fascinating, which is, before we get into anything else, explain to us what VinWiki is. And am I saying that right? Wiki?
Wiki, kind of like Wikipedia. The idea is that we're crowdsourcing vehicle history. So the best way to think of it is like a social version of Carfax. So we invite anyone to contribute to the historical timeline of any car by its VIN or by its license plate. And what that builds is a much more kind of living and breathing record of what a car's done, where it's been, who's known something about it, than you might find with other traditional data sources. So whereas Carfax or AutoCheck rely on institutional data to build out the history of a car, we let people take control, add DIY service, anything from, mileage logging and detailing or anything they want to do. So it's been interesting the last 2 years since we launched the free app to see all the ways people have used it. And that's what it is. It's free to download in the Apple or Android Play Store. And it's been fun. I did not necessarily set out to be a tech entrepreneur, but it's really based on a lot of the practices that I had in the way that I would buy and sell cars personally, and also the way I'd represent cars at the dealership, because I was the director of sales at Lamborghini Atlanta from 2009 to 2015. So learned a lot about the different ways that we can sort of curate the history of a car and how that can be used to increase the value and maintain the value and make it an easier process when you want to find the next owner.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's like one of the things right now when you buy let's say you go out and you buy a classic Porsche, you want, dealer records, you want, every time it's seen an oil change, belt change, and, every receipt they've ever had, and we're all going paperless. So everyone's going paperless. They have
right ahead.
All right, and we're back. Little glitch, so apologize for that. But as I was saying, so, you know, we're all going paperless. It's going to be one of those things where 20 years from now, you got a classic Porsche. You're not going to be able to keep that binder, and no one's going to be able to, you know, really stay up on top of it, you know, because no one really gets paper receipts anymore. But if you're able to go to Van Winkie and say, hey, this is, you know, all the stuff I've done, here's photos of it or screenshots of all the work, then you can kind of build your catalog there. Or if you're a crazy person like me and you pick a, you know, beat up piece of crap like a 85 Fiero, you're able to kind of start the timeline all over again. And it, you know, here's the car. It looked damaged and destroyed. Now it's getting repaired and made better. And you can kind of, you know, approach it at your own angle, which is what I think is one of the very fascinating things about the site and the application.
And that's part of the goal. You know, one thing about keeping a good record of the history on the car, most of us have always done it in folders or binders or something like that, and then we just hand it to the next person. So you've put, you know, dozens of hours into maintaining this history, and the person who buys your car literally just takes it from you. And since they don't have as much invested, they end up losing it. And I don't know how many cars I would sell and, you know, give them everything they could ever want about the history of the car just to find out that when they traded it back in 6 or 12 months later, they don't have any of it. And, you know, so the idea that something just kind of gets put in that anyone can contribute to makes it a whole lot easier for it to kind of continue to exist as a living, breathing document.
Mm-hmm. And one of the fascinating things, too, is signing up for the site. You're able to, if you don't even know your VIN, but you got the, you know, plate registered, I was able to punch in my plate. It pulls up the VIN and asks you, is this the car you're putting in? And it tells you what it is, and you're able to pick it up from there. And you're able to, I like the worldwide feed, so you can kind of see who's done what, you know, and just anytime you log into the site, you can kind of see who's working on their car, or who's doing something silly with their car, who's looking back at something they did with their car. It's a wonderful
thing. Yeah, it's designed to be kind of a social experience, and we're still figuring out what it is. I mean, even though we've been live for a couple of years, you know, it's one of those things we're constantly kind of tweaking on and trying to figure out different ways people use it. And I've been impressed with all the different ways that people have. We let people build lists of their cars, so I made a list of all the cars I've ever owned, so I can look back and see where they've gone or what else has happened to them. And that's great, you know, because we've always been really good at understanding our own ownership of a car. But to look back at all the other things that have happened before, we got pretty good at, but seeing what happens afterwards is really, really hard to do. And I used to always Google my VINs and check the Carfaxes years later and just to see what had happened. But this is a way for that to happen a little bit more easily.
And I think it's a little better for, as an example, the site wasn't out then. I had a Dodge Challenger that was bought back by Dodge. Shocking. Mm-hmm. When I went and turned the plates in at the DMV, you know, about a month after they did the buyback, all the paperwork was settled and all that, I turned the plate back in the DMV. They run a little history report and go, hey, did you know your car was already sold in Texas? And do you know it's already been in a shop twice? I'm like, well, no, I didn't. But it's one of those things where the next owner can be a little bit more informed. You know, if you go to a dealership, you can plug it in and, you know, it's, the uses are out there, and it's kind of everything you want in, you know, VIN search without having to, you know, pay an exorbitant amount with Carfax. And even then, you don't really get the full history of the car, and you also get the social aspect of it, which makes it a lot more, you know, pleasant. You can see what the car looked like, what happened, how bad was the crash, and all that stuff. You know.
That is certainly the hope.
Yeah. So I find that fascinating. I love this. I will kind of come back and talk more about that. And there's also the YouTube side about it, which is you're interviewing people. You know, you've been on the YouTube side yourself, and it's, you got stories and kind of what we try to do here on the show, where you're able to bring on interesting people and they tell stories about what they did in the car. And it's, you know, 10-minute segments maybe, and you tell a fascinating story, or someone else from, you know, renown in the automotive world comes in and shares a little interesting tale.
Perfect. Yeah. So about a year ago, we launched a YouTube channel the way a lot of companies do, just to kind of use that to direct some traffic towards the app. And it's been a brilliantly effective tool for us, and certainly grown into sort of its own thing. But really, each of the stories that me or one of my friends tell as a car story is a blown up post that could very well belong in our app. And it's been great to reach a broader audience and direct more people to the app. But it's also just been a whole lot of fun to tell the stories and kind of, you know, immortalize them in something that can be accessed in the future. I've enjoyed telling some stories and having other people come in, and everybody has a good car story.
Mm-hmm. When I was tweeting at you earlier a bit about this, you know, there's some great stories on there, but then there's some great stories that you'll never be able to tell, maybe for slightly legal reasons, which is fascinating.
You work in the car business for long enough, and there's some you can tell, and a whole lot you got to take with you.
Yeah, like there's only two people on the planet who know about this, and neither one of us is going to say anything. So, like Shawshank, like on the death. See, that's, you should have a Vin Winky on the deathbed. There we go. like, tell my story. Man. Yeah. Even then, it might not be a bright idea. So, we'll talk. What I like to do too is I like to bring on, and I'd like to do a pivot test. I'm mispronouncing that terribly, but it's basically the inside the actor studio's questions, but for the automotive enthusiast. So these are questions that may change hour by hour, minute by minute, but we're just trying to capture who you are as an automotive enthusiast as we sit and speak today. So, you know, just kind of
fair enough.
First questions that come off your head. So what is your favorite car?
My favorite car is my manual transmission Lamborghini Murcielago LP640.
What is your least favorite car?
When we got married, my wife had, of all things, a 2000 Ford Mustang automatic V6 convertible that was just atrocious and had the worst build quality and was falling apart in every way. And we weren't exactly in a position to buy her something else terribly quickly. And it was so far beyond not safe with ineffective headlights and everything else that I ended up driving it more than I ever wanted to put her in my car. But I was never happier with a car deal than to let that one go.
What modification trend, maybe something that you want to do to your own car, maybe something you would, but you look at it and you go, I really like the look of that on cars.
I actually released a video today of how to prepare oneself for their first exotic car purchase. That's one of those emails that I get daily from some enthusiast around there. It's like, hey, you bought all these cool cars. Like, how do I do it? And the line that I started it out with is, modifying your car that you're not going to keep forever is like having premarital sex. It limits your future options. It gives you a lot of explaining to do. And you're going to have to, regardless of whether it's a good decision or not, it's something you get to answer for in the future.
I agree with you on that, but the answer still stands, sir. Which is your favorite?
My favorite, coming from the dealership side, you start to hate all modifications because they generally, as we've learned from Top Gear and everywhere else, they just make cars worse. And I like a loud exhaust and some good looking wheels and things like that. But having watched so many Lamborghini differentials wrecked by the wrong size wheels and tires, it's very, very hard. I've learned a lot lately about the RWB Porsche craze. And I recently bought a very inexpensive 993 that I had a lot of people that wanted to buy it from me to do RWB builds. And I've had some of the guys that are involved in that come and tell stories. And it's really not me, and anybody that knows me knows it's not me, but the culture and the idea behind it does absolutely intrigue me. And so I don't know. I can't necessarily see myself doing it, but I know the guys there pretty well, and you never know.
Mm-hmm. And that's basically like a rally-prepped Porsche, if I'm remembering correctly, right?
That's Lee Keen's Safari stuff. I like that a lot too, but as you start to get into – he likes, you know – the late 70s, really early 80s 911s. And even though he and I are about the same height, 6'4", 6'5", fitting in those cars comfortably gets to be a little bit tough. And they're not that fast. So apart from being able to jump over things and go through water, that novelty is a little tough to enjoy. The RWB thing is kind of this Japanese/Malaysian modification trend where you throw these super wide fenders on and, you know, drop the car down, usually requiring air ride and new bumpers and big wings like Pikes Peak style. And it's a very, you know, compelling looking car. Whether you like it or not, it really kind of commands your attention. And they're supposedly they drive quite well. I've never driven one, but I understand that there is some thought that goes into the way that they're built and engineered.
What is, I think this would be a much easier question for you. What's your least favorite modification trend?
This, you know, in excessive camber stance stuff that makes a car not function like an automobile. I see no redemptive value there.
What car do you dread being stuck behind at a red light?
That's a good question. How about a Nissan Murano Cross Cabriolet without a license plate on it? We have a good list of those going. I think we've got almost all of them on VinWiki. And as long as it's got a license plate, we can add it. But if I see one in that one, I get frustrated.
Yeah.
Same for an R63 without a license plate. That would kill me.
A unique take on the question, but I like it. What automotive sound or noise do you love?
The howl of a Lamborghini V12 is as good as it gets for me.
What automotive sound or noise do you hate?
Squeaky brakes.
It's a fairly common one.
It is. We now that they put carbon ceramics on so many cars, the issue we used to run into is that they only really work when you really use them. And most of the people that buy a early Ferrari California, they never drive them hard enough to really get into the brakes. They squeal like crazy. And you can't just fix it by addressing the car in any way other than going out and driving the heck out of the thing. So if we sold one, almost inevitably a few days later, somebody would come back and be complaining about the brakes. And in addition to telling them they needed to press the pedal a little bit harder, usually it would become my responsibility to take it out on the highway nearby and run it up to about 150 and brake really hard and really smooth down to 60 to 80 miles an hour several times so that they would kind of bed in and scuff off the uneven layer of the pad to quiet them down.
What profession other than your own in the automotive world would you like to try?
Well, like most of us, I think I sent in a one of those 30-second audition reels for the latest edition of Top Gear. But apart from that, I don't know. I'm pretty happy where I'm at. I certainly don't miss the car sales side of things. I thought after I left the dealership, I had done some interviews with some of the manufacturers, and I thought I was going to end up running the finance programs for Bugatti, Lamborghini, and Bentley for Porsche Financial Services. Mm-hmm. But I was very comfortable with the pay cut that it required because it sounded like a really fun job, but they didn't convince themselves that I was as comfortable as I actually was. So they went with an internal hire after telling me repeatedly that, you know, you're both overqualified and exactly what we need. So I think that would have been a fun job.
What part of this profession do you think you'd be the worst at, or do you think that you would least want to do?
Service. You never meet a happy service guy. And I'm not much of a wrench myself, but I you know, it's all out there on YouTube, so you can learn a lot. But that is one of those things that I have never envied. And the fact that everything that you do is meeting someone on a fundamentally bad day, it's just a tough place for me to start. I don't envy those guys at all.
All right. Now I'm going to give you a choice of two cars, and you made this quite difficult, so I had to kind of go on my way to make it interesting. So you have to take this car. This is the only car. This is going to be difficult for you. This is the only car you're allowed to drive from now on. This is your daily driver. You want to go cannonball, and you got to take one of these two. So, and you're not allowed to modify it beyond how it's already been modified. So the first one is you get a 2005 Mustang V6 automatic. Yep, you see how this goes? But it's basically been, you know, it's got the RBW modifications to it. So it's been done all well. It's got a nice sounding exhaust. You know, the wheels are tasteful. It's just totally done out in that style. your other car is your Lamborghini Murcielago, but it's been stanced ridiculously to like within an inch of its life. You, like, you're driving on millimeters of wheels. So which one do you take?
Among those terrible options, I think I'll still go with my Lamborghini. It's just, it's almost that useless from the base case, which is actually what I love most about it. It's just such a caricature of an automobile that even making it that much worse, there's only so much worse it's even capable of being as a real car. So I think I could manage.
So I think we've gotten to a very core fundamental of who you are as a car guy with that little questionnaire there. I thought
that's
for sure.
Test.
I'm picturing you though trying to cannonball across the country with a Murcielago now that's like been it's like stanced out. Like I don't think you could do over like 20 miles per hour. Like
that would be a problem. Yeah, the last Lamborghini I drove back from where I purchased it in Las Vegas because if there's any opportunity to avoid automotive transporters, I do that. And I love a good road trip. So we drove it back and not at cannonball pace, but we did all right. And it took me days to recover from sitting in that car for, you know, two and a half, three days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's having driven through some of those parts of the South that you were going through, I can only, you know, assume that whoever your chiropractor or back surgeon is well paid. So, So speaking of cannonball, you currently hold a record or two in that event. I suppose it's a little disputed between you and Mr. Alex Roy. We're not even going to talk about that gas monkey guy. he doesn't count. I'm sure I've been told he's an absolute delight, but we'll just go ahead and move him aside for a second. So I'm more curious about how you decided this was going to be a good idea. There's a video out. I'm not sure if it's one of your Finn Winky channel or if it's someone else who interviewed you, but my understanding is you had a discussion with, Brock Yates, the founder of the Cannonball event. And that kind of led you down a path where you're like, well, of course I can do it better than you can. Is that more or less accurate?
Well, not exactly, of course. But, yeah, I had a good conversation with Brock Yates as a high school senior back in 2004. And I told him that one day I wanted to, see what this looked like in a modern context. And I wanted to learn, what using a more capable, obviously newer car would do along the same course with, the different roads that have been built and the different traffic and policing circumstances that we encounter. Because, we can read all the Nürburgring lap times and 0-60 times and 60-130 times and everything else that we, get to read and digest from the automotive media. But the idea of what car can go across a real road the fastest to me was always just hugely compelling. And I loved the idea of cannonball from a very young age and was just, fascinated by the whole thing. And so I talked to Yates and, he was cordial, even though he had just finished his book that he released in 2001, saying, that the times from 1979-3251 could never be beaten. And he never really had a great deal of respect for the U.S. Express, which followed behind from 81-83. And the fastest time out of that was 3207. Which is reminiscent of the video that Alex helped to produce with Corey Wells. And, Alex has been great. I talked to him a lot both before and after we set the record, and I know it was hard on him. And fortunately now I think he's come to terms with it, but it becomes a big part of your identity. And yeah, we set the world record in 2013 at 2850. And then in 2015, we did the 2904, which might have even been more fun, to be quite honest, because, there wasn't really a competitive venue for this. And so guys like Alex and myself and Rawlings, we all just went out with this goal in mind that we wanted to sort of add ourselves to the chronicles of history with this. But I enjoyed that a lot. We did 3205 in that 2015 running, and that's kind of the competitive event, New York to LA record. And then In 2016, there was another event for old cars. So all the cars had to be sort of period correct, 1979 and earlier. And we did it in a 74 Dodge Monaco dressed as a Bluesmobiles without air conditioning and did 3416. So kind of that's the antique car record, I suppose, for whatever that's worth. So it's been awesome to kind of, you know, join this fraternity of lunatics that sort of still care about this idea and, you know, add myself to whatever record books exist.
And so part of what's so compelling about me that you do this, like, I love Alex. He's a great guy. You know, Rollins, again, teasing a little bit, but I've heard good things. But in your particular case, when you were doing this, you were working at a Lamborghini dealership, is my understanding. You know, working in that field, you know, for the other guys, it'd be bad for them if they got taken out and thrown in jail. But for you, it's a little bit more of like, I'm sure Lamborghini would very much frown upon someone, you know, getting busted doing, you know, 150 down the highway. So I feel like the stakes were always kind of set a little bit higher for you than for the other two. And I mean, you guys are kind of the current, you know, three champions of this event. So like, did that ever factor into the way you handled your preparation or anything? Do you think maybe you were a little bit more cautious than the other guys or more countermeasures when you did it?
I certainly didn't have as many countermeasures as Alex did. I think we both had considerably more preparation towards the idea than Rawlings. But, you know, it's one of those things that as you prepare, and I did so over almost a decade, it hits you over time, you know, what risks you're taking and just the magnitude of what you're trying to do and the number of people who have tried and obviously not been as successful as you're trying to be, as most of whom had way more money and, you know, more advantages. But that all set in over the course, particularly over the last 6 months leading up to it. And you learn a lot about yourself. And I wrote a book about it that, you know, certainly is about the drive, but it's a lot more about the preparation and sort of what I learned about myself through finding a goal that I felt like I was, you know, made eligible to achieve, just the parts of my personality that it highlighted, the problem solving that it demanded, but also just the way that I was able to do it. And I felt honored to have found the right challenge for my strengths, for my weaknesses, and for the opportunity to learn through it.
Is there a, in your mind, is there a bigger race or bigger kind of event that one can do in terms of like single car challenge, so trying to set a time that's really bigger than doing the Cannonball? Like, you know, Nuremberg means something to some people, but I think if you sat down and asked the common person which is more impressive, you know, I think they would say Cannonball record over the Nuremberg rig. Not that I'm saying that the skills are equal, but it's in terms of something the average person can sit down, work out and do. Not that you should, anyone listening, very bad idea. For legal reasons, I gotta say that. But I mean,
you know, the Nürburgring record, you know, that the recent Porsche prototype run was obviously unfathomable to watch. And, you know, the recent Koenigsegg top speed record for a production car out on the roads in Nevada, I mean, that's all just as epic in its own regard and maybe even more understood because more people have heard of it. I mean, certainly there's an audience for Cannonball, and I couldn't have been happier to have found the right game to play. But, you know, that's the great thing about the automotive hobby. You know, for all those modifications that I'm not crazy about, there's people who think it's the greatest thing that's ever been invented. And that's one of the cool things about our car stories. You know, this week we've had a Maxima getting stolen that the internet kind of crowdsourced the rebuilding of. We had a guy who did the biggest Viper deal in history with six simultaneous group deliveries at the factory. I gave some advice on how to buy your first exotic car, presumably to people who have never even, you know, had the chance to sit in or drive one. You know, tomorrow I've got a guy who got his first job in the car business because he was on MTV Room Raiders. I mean, there's all sorts of different things, different angles with which we approach the automotive hobby. And that's what I think is the most beautiful thing about it is that just because this was something that really worked for me and might even define me in some ways as an automotive enthusiast doesn't mean that it's what anybody should do. I mean, somebody else might want to win Pebble Beach or, you know, just build their own car. That's exactly what they want. I mean, that any of those goals are just as laudable. What's important, though, is that we find the things that resonate enough with our gifts, with our ideas, with our interest, and with what we want the world to believe about us with respect to our enthusiasm for the hobby.
That might be the most, like, profound thing that was ever said on this show. No, it's not a terribly high bar on this show because it's typically, you know, pretty lowbrow here. But, no, I mean, it's true. And I'm curious, you know, is there another rally that you would like to do? I mean, there's been this, upswing recently, you know. I think SCCA does one now. You got the Lemons Rally. You got the Gambler stuff. Is there another kind of road event like that that you kind of see yourself going towards? Or is it Cannonball? And, like, that's because that is such a high bar that's been set. You know, the 2904 is very interesting. Kind of like Cannonball meets 24 Hours of Lemons deal. Is that kind exactly. of more like that's your adrenaline. That's what gets you, and that's the only thing that's going to satiate it.
No, I mean, I love any chance to get in a car and certainly any chance to go on a road trip. So all these rallies I think are interesting. But, you know, they're all also kind of solve problems in the automotive space. And so I kind of like a little bit of that pioneering spirit to be able to approach these ideas a little bit more creatively. Mm-hmm. So the Pan American Highway has always kind of enamored me. The Pan American Highway is one of those things that's always enthralled me. Just this idea, it's like, I think it's 16,000 miles, mm-hmm. and you have to ferry around Darien Gap, and you have to not get kidnapped in Northwest Colombia, and you have to build a car that can drive that, and the record's about 11 and a half days. Yeah. So, you know, that would be pretty awesome, and take even more preparation, probably. But a whole different set of risks and obstacles. So something like that I could enjoy, Peking to Paris, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's – I'm trying to think. The furthest I think that you can actually drive in the world is – it ends on the coast where you go into the Channel to go to London on the western part. And I believe it, like, ends – at, like, where we would be allowed to go as Americans. Like, I think you can get all the way over to, like, through Mongolia to, like, the North Korean border. There's, like, a dirt road that will take you there. So it's, like, that's an interesting idea. And, like, I think you could even, like, throw in, like, trying to go down to Rafika if you throw ferries and stuff into it. Is there – if someone came and threw down a gauntlet, a challenge, like, here's a crazy idea – like someone burst in like, Ed, I got a crazy idea, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to get in the car, and we're going to drive from, you know, the southern tip of South America. I got a ferry in Alaska. We're going to go across, and we're going to drive all the way down to South Africa. You in? Is there anything that would be too nuts for you to say now, you know, hold on, you got to – maybe we shouldn't do this. Or is it as long as the logistics are there, you're down for whatever is up?
I'm pretty down. There has been some discussion of a circumnavigation race.
That'd be fascinating. Like, why is that? The license plate thing would be probably the most interesting thing. I'm fascinated by it. And I'm sure, you know, maybe there's a story that will be told on that you will never be able to tell again. But I want to see that happen. I know some people have tried it in bigger and crazy trucks and stuff, but I think you got it. I think you could do it. I'll just throw out stupid ideas to you, and that'll be
appreciate the vote of confidence.
Yeah, we'll try and not get you killed with my crazy ideas. Now, this is a question I typically save for later, but I feel like you might have a wonderful answer for it based on all your experience road tripping and all that. And this is a graded challenge, so just bear that in mind. What's the hardest food to eat while driving?
Anything, you know, fast food is obviously what people try to eat, but the way it's packaged, you know, big cheesy burgers and stuff like that, that stuff's almost impossible. I mean, we tend to go with Kind bars, granola bars, things like that, beef jerky. That's all good road trip food. But the stuff that you find convenient in such moments is never easy.
All right. Oh, went the wrong thing. But what is the hardest thing to eat? I'm sure you maybe got an idea of, like, you know, I'll give you fourth place right now is a Kit Kat bar based on the mess. You know, only if you eat it the right way. If you eat it the wrong way, like an animal where you don't break it, then you're just a crazy person. And like third place is a rotisserie chicken. So,
oh, okay.
I'm just saying, can I'll give you the rundown. So number one is a fondue by the podcast group Everyone Racers. And number two is matzo ball soup by Matt Hardigree. Do you think you could top any of those?
I would say a properly cooked steak.
See, the steak is good, but you can always just eat it like a caveman, and you just stick the fork in and eat it like a caveman. Ask me how I know.
Right. But I think if we're going to regress to such barbarian tactics, we don't need to be in a car at all.
True. I mean, but what goes better with a car than a steak? Well, now that's an interesting question I didn't even think about till just now. Is there a celebratory meal or event you do when you finish off these cannonballs?
Well, so you want to be strategic, obviously, about what time you're encountering the bookends of the trip. So we depart late in the evening from New York City, but not so late that we don't make it through St. Louis before people start waking up to go to church. Mm-hmm. And that permits you to come into L.A. After rush hour, but before the morning. So you come into Redondo Beach, sweaty, smelly, and exhausted, and you want to eat, but there's nothing open because it's a little beach town. So the only place there is to go is around the corner. There's a Denny's. And so pretty much each year we wind up at Denny's at 3 in the morning trying to, you know, figure out how to order food and read and in all the exhaustion.
So what you're saying is you have a moons over Miami every time you get in?
Pretty much. When we finished in 2013, we got there. You know, the only table in the whole place is set, and there's this gigantic Samoan guy that's the waiter, and my co-driver is delirious. And he's like, can I have – I think it was like sausage, eggs, and toast. And so the guy's like, so you want a grand slam, like literally the most common thing on our menu? And he's like, yeah, I guess. And they looked at us like, you know, we're, you know, stoned out of our minds. But no, we've just been driving for 28 hours and change.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, we were in New York, you know, just over a day ago. Like, oh, you flew? No. So I know there's, and again, if you're interested in this, you need to go check out the VinWiki. There's even a helpful playlist with all your stories on it. And I know there's one where you outran the American Express, you know, whatchamacallit, like analysis So you need to go check out that one because that's hilarious. So we'll ask you the other part of that question because I'm also curious about this. What do you think is the hardest makeup to apply while driving?
You'd imagine, you know, that was one of the most fascinating things about the drive is that if you think, you know, the average American drives about 1,000 miles a month, you know, in a commuting area, certainly not in a ultra urban setting, but in the aggregate. And so think about all the craziness that you've encountered in the last 3 months of driving. We get that in a little over a day. So you see people putting on every form of makeup, and certainly the most difficult and the most treacherous for the people around you is definitely toenail polish.
Yep. You, sir, have earned yourself into the leader of the clubhouse because I think you discovered the most difficult one. That's good.
Because inevitably, as you're doing it and holding the vial of whatever nail polish it is and the brush, that means you're steering with your toes that you are painting.
This is we got a new leader in the clubhouse, sir. I am impressed. I didn't think it would happen.
I've got a new thing for my email signature. Fantastic.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I want to let you know you kicked off the leaderboard putting on insane clown posse makeup. So.
Yeah. So the artistic liberty, you know, is a good nod there, but glad to raise the bar.
I mean, yeah, there you go. You set a new record. You hold the first place on this. I'm glad we could help out with that, helping set new records. Or new titles, I guess, technically. So, yeah. And what's crazy is as soon as you said that, I remembered a moment in time where I saw a person in a four-door Jeep, doors off the side, painting their toenails up on the dashboard. Obviously, cruise control had to be on. And I'm like, where the hell is a cop when you need one? Because this person is literally driving by cruise control in their little four-door automatic Jeep. I have no idea. Like, both feet are up on the dash. Like, this just seems like that would hurt. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And I can top that. I have seen painting toenails while on the phone and smoking a cigarette.
Yeah.
And of course, a good word of warning to your audience is that the absolute worst thing you can do while in a moving automobile is to put your legs on the dashboard.
Yeah.
As driver or passenger.
Yeah.
If you talk to any emergency personnel, they will tell you that the most horrific results of accidents are the people who began the drive with their feet on the dashboard.
Yeah. It drives me nuts. I have actually broken up with girlfriends over that thing. Like, I'm not going to have you in my car with your feet. A, it's disrespectful. B, I don't want to see what happens when I inevitably put this thing in a ditch and the airbag goes off. So.
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. I have a voice that's not to be negotiated against, and that is the voice that comes out when my wife tries to do that.
It's like, we've had this discussion, sweetheart. Like, put the feet down. That's just scary because, like we were saying with the technical glitches, I think your calling in life you missed was hostage negotiator. But, you know, I would hate to see you angry at someone. So, speaking of that, though, I'm curious, is there a cannonballing faux pas, whether it's someone in the vehicle with you or something maybe someone does while cannonballing that's frowned upon in your book?
Oh, there's plenty of things that are frowned upon. I mean, you know, it's interesting because people assume that it's a very dramatic and exciting thing. And you know, over the years, I've had different people approach me about different, like, screenplay ideas and movie stuff and really trying to dramatize the whole notion of what cannonball is. But in reality, it's pretty smooth, undramatic. I mean, yes, you're going fast and certainly maintaining higher speeds, but the statistics, you know, looking at it by the numbers is a lot more impressive than actually watching it. And so anything that's distracting is just entirely unacceptable. I mean, we didn't play the radio, you know, nobody's playing I Spy, looking around, doing anything other than, you know, look at what lane's available, look at what other cars are doing, make sure everything on the car is perfect, look at all the reports coming in from all the countermeasures and all the navigational devices and, you know, obviously spot for cops. And so essentially not paying attention is unforgivable. And although I suppose a good example is in the 2015 running of the 2904, I ended up having as a co-driver one of the guys who I had strategically planned a lot of this with. And he had always been kind of the front runner to be my co-driver for the attempt in 2013. But he had a work obligation that he simply couldn't get out of. And so I ended up going down the list and at the 11th hour finding a co-driver and then actually a different navigational passenger for us to have. And so he was able to come on 2904, but he runs a big construction operation and he has a CDL. And he got scared of speeding in that time.
Yeah.
And so he wouldn't go more than about 90 miles an hour. And I'm like, dude, what are you doing? And he's like, oh man, I can't get a ticket going 120 miles an hour. I'm like, well, can you get a ticket going 92 or 90? Can you go any faster? And he's like, nah, man, that's what I'm going to do.
Ugh.
Oh my goodness. You got to be kidding me. So we had actually brought with us on that trip with a master Mercedes technician. And the reason for that was when I was invited by the organizer of 2904 to come with them on another attempt at this drive, I said I would do it as long as I could sort of find something that fit within their rule set that was reasonably similar to the CL that we had used, because I thought it was going to take us 4, 5, 6 tries to set the record, and I would have more time to solve the problems and re-engineer the car and just, you know, keep doing some of the more fun preparatory stuff, and I never needed to. So I wanted to pick up where I'd left off on the 2904. And when we had the 1 year anniversary party of the record, the Ed's not in jail because the statute of limitations has run out party, one of the mechanics that had worked on the car from RBM North, the Mercedes-Benz dealership in North Atlanta, he came and said, hey, like a lot of people say this, you know, if you ever go again, I want to go with you. But not a whole lot of people have the skill set to truly earn their keep like this guy did. And so once I kind of looked at what kind of car I was going to get, and I found a 2002 S55 AMG that had 12 owners and 2 accidents and some frame damage and a salvage title, and the dash didn't work and the window was stuck down and the air suspension was, or the hydraulic suspension was collapsed, and it was stranded in Los Angeles, I said, look, I'm going to need this guy to give me a whole bunch of free labor to come along with me so I can fit all within the budget. And so he agreed to come, but he didn't really want to drive. And I can drive a lot of it, but, you know, 60 to 65% is about all I've got. So I ended up doing that. He did probably 30%, and the other guy did 5 to 10% because we just couldn't deal with 90 miles an hour.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. The faux pas is not speeding enough. So
absolutely.
So when it comes to, like, if you could – let's say Warren Buffett gets really bored and he says, I want you to set a new record and I want you to go do one run. Here's an unlimited budget. Here's everything you'll ever want or need for it. Just blank check, go out and do it. Is there like an ideal way in your mind that you would handle it?
So after the record, sorry, I got a text message that chimed in there.
That's fine.
After the record, I obviously, you know, had a lot of conversations about it, particularly with my customers. And there was a guy, he was an old Air Force guy that had started a kind of a exotic car driving experience thing that ran around air shows. So he bought a Ferrari and a Lamborghini from me that he would let people ride in going nearly 200 miles an hour on these airstrips while these, you know, old fighter jets and Blue Angel stuff are flying around. And he was fascinated by Cannonball, but he had the only currently air quote available technology advantage that I'd ever heard of. And he said that for a while he was stationed at a base near Area 51. And it was off a road that was about 50 miles that literally only went to the base. And they would drive as fast as they wanted every single day to get to work. And one of the things they did out of that base was fly Predator drones.
Hmm.
And to see who was on their way to work, they would fly the drones out over this road to see what was going on. So the idea of sending a drone out ahead had always been kind of interesting, but these electric drones, you know, barely do 30 to 40 miles an hour, and even the racing drones are only doing 70, 80,
yeah.
And their range is a few miles, mm-hmm. And the quality of the video footage is bad. So he's like, no, man, you know, you can't go in airspace, but I could requisition one of these drones for you. And I'm like, dude, you don't need to make a promise that you can't cash here, sir, because that is about as enticing as an offer that I've ever heard.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, call me someday. But, yeah, a Predator drone would definitely be the solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was not expecting that way with it, but I could see how that would work perfectly. I mean, worst case scenario, you're flying over, like, there's the cops, like, well – not shoot at the cops, but you got hellfire.
You might not want to finish that sentence on something that goes on the internet.
I'm just saying you could send a warning, like, there you go.
Yeah. Across the bow.
Exactly. You know, never hurt anyone. That's the thing. Because that's what it's all about, is if the cannonball was truly dangerous and truly something that was a menace to society, you know, you'd be incarcerated somewhere probably along with Alex, and, you know, Rollins would probably somehow schmooze his way out of it. But you probably would too. It'd probably just be poor Alex left in there alone with his leather jackets. But like, you got a fancy three-wheeler, boy. That's kind of what makes it delightful, is it's kind of that old American spirit of, you know, outlaw, but not really a dangerous thing. And you have some fun while, you know, maybe a 65 mile per hour speed limit doesn't make sense through rural Kansas. You know, it's a way of being like, this is a silly thing. So do you think, you know, since we're kind of going down that thing, do you think that's kind of the statement that you're secretly making, maybe subconsciously? Or do you think this is something that you're, you know, it's just for the lulz, as the kids would say?
You know, Yeats always used the mentality of run silent, run deep. And they were fairly famous for talking about the fact that they had driven all the way across the country at speeds over 170 miles an hour, and no one really knew about it. And I think that's part of the mystique. It's part of the history. It's part of the precedent, but it's also true. I mean, you know, it's not this huge disturbance of some butterfly flapping its wings in Kansas that just, you know, disturbs the entire landscape of automotive Americana. It's something that has historical precedent, that is interesting, that most people, whether they ever, you know, really put their foot all the way to the floor in their car, they've at least fantasized about the idea of what would it be like to just drive like that. And I think that's what's redemptive, is that it's not this novel concept. This is an idea. Yeah, this is a part of American car history that, whether we like it or not, it's there. And it's one of these challenges that, as long as we're building these gigantic interstate highways, the idea of truly conquering them is something that, you know, people are going to want to go out and do. And you're right. It's not to hurt anyone. It's not to take any unnecessary risk. But the fact that there's never been a serious accident in the pursuance of this record, to me, you know, is the greatest thing about it. It's this idea that qualified people the way Yeats phrased it was, capable people in capable cars are capable of driving a whole lot faster than 55 miles an hour.
Right. And, you know, it's a lot different now than even it was back when he did it, where, you know, these cars are safe, and a lot of the cars that you've chosen to drive, I'm curious if this is purposefully, are German cars that have been rated to run on the Autobahn, which is unlimited speed. So, you know.
And that is both pragmatic and somewhat inevitable. I mean, you know, obviously, as sexy as it is to drive a Ferrari or a Lamborghini or a McLaren, they're not the greatest cars for long-distance road trips. And I love a 550 Maranello as good as anybody, but, you know, the idea of an M5 or a Mercedes AMG car relative to even a 2+2 Ferrari like an FF is tough. I mean, it's tough to beat. So I was really, really happy with the choice of the CL, and would have done an S if I had just found a, you know, better deal on Craigslist in the year before I was, as I was preparing. But they are built for it. They are comfortable. They are capable. And even though they're very expensive to maintain at times, it's hard to find a better weapon for the fight.
Mm. Well, I just looked up at the time, and I realized I kept you for a little bit over an hour now, so I don't want to keep you for too long. I could pick your brain all night. I feel like I'll close this on, you know, a stupid question, as is the way we do around here at the show. So what would be the worst car to do to Cannonball in?
probably the car that I gave you is my favorite. As much as I love it, the Murcielago, you never get anywhere fast in an exotic car. You go fast, but you don't get anywhere fast. And it is very, very hard to maintain a really high average in a very, very fast sports car. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make them not worth it. It doesn't make them not awesome. But if you really want to go somewhere fast, comfortable and efficient is the way to go.
Mm. Is it because it draws too much attention or because you'll get out and you'll be debilitated?
Both of those things, certainly.
See, I thought you were going to say a smart car, but, you know. it's the only car I can think of.
I bet if I put you in a Lamborghini and I take the smart car, I bet I can finish with a better average over 2,800 miles.
Hmm. You know, I love smart cars, so I'm not going to say you're wrong because I'm a crazy person.
You love smart cars?
So the first gen in the U.S., garbage. The second gen, the gen before the upcoming year with the model change, you can get a rear-wheel drive. Well, they're all rear-wheel drive with a manual transmission, cabriolet. You know, for a while, there was the only German rear-wheel drive rear-engine sports car you could get. And you could get it with a convertible top. It's basically a mini Porsche. I mean, come on.
Basically. And, yeah. I can't fault your logic.
Yeah, I know. It is probably, out of all my automotive opinions, it is probably my most idiotic one. But have you driven one of them, the last generation with the manual transmission?
No, but we had most auto manufacturers have a built-in loaner car program.
Yeah.
But the exotic car manufacturers do not. The real solution is to pick up all your customers' cars on a flatbed. But that's something that the management of my dealership always refused to do. And so we had loaner cars, but they were always the cheapest available option. And so forever, they were early 2000s Ford Tauruses. And no one wants to drop off a Lamborghini and drive a Ford Taurus home, regardless of how free it is. Mm-hmm. And the guy that owned the dealership just would never accept the fact that we needed better loaner cars. And every time we'd hire somebody, their first like piece of advice would be, hey, we need to refresh the loaner fleet. And we're like, nope, that's just the thing you don't say. It's the fight you don't pick. Until one day, someone convinced him that we needed to buy a fleet of smart cars. And you could lease them for like $85 a month.
Yeah.
And so he bought six or seven of them. And goodness gracious, they were awful. Because they were the CVT cars were just terrible. And our service manager, part of his pay plan was to get to drive one. But he was like 6'6", 320 pounds. And so he himself would upset the capability of the car simply by being inside of it. And it was unbelievable to watch. And we kept waiting on him as he'd speed out of the parking lot and make a right turn to just fall on his side in the middle of the road. But goodness gracious, they were some garbage.
Yeah, that first generation in the U.S. with that transmission was atrocious. The last generation, which I think they're replacing with an all-electric fleet now, which ruins it for me, are actually secretly super fun, but only with the manual transmission and only with the convertible. So if you get a chance, you know, when you're out doing the cars and coffee, you're cannonball across the country, and you see one of those, drive it. I'm telling you, it is worth it. You know?
I might just have to take your word for it.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's my most divisive opinion as a car guy, but it's one I hold fast to. So, Ed, it's, you know, we ended with something, you know, completely out of left field, as is our want around here. And it's been an absolute delight to have you. Again, everyone listening, you need to go check out Vin Winkie, the YouTube page, and you need to go sign up for the app or go to the website, put your car in, and go follow Ed's cars he's owned list, because there's some fascinating stuff in there.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
Oh, then it was a delight. Ed, where else can we find you? Is there anything I'm missing? You know, I know you got a book for the record out there.
It's on Amazon. You can follow me on pretty much everything at Ed Bolian. And stay tuned. We'll keep telling good car stories.
Excellent. All right, Ed, I will say goodbye to you off air. Everyone who's listening, I will be right back. So thanks, everyone, so much for listening. I apologize again for any vocal or glitches we had. Still not 100% sure what was going on early on in the recording, but hopefully it's been fixed and remedied. It won't be an issue in future podcasts. So if you like what you hear, please tell a friend, loved one, coworker. Make sure to check out everything Vin Winky does, everything Ed Bolian does. He's a fascinating character. I really wish I could sit down and pick his brain for longer. But the great thing about Vin Winky is he has, no matter how many times I say that, I always feel like I'm saying it wrong. Winky. I can't. It's a problem with having parents who are immigrants, is the English language sometimes not so great. So thanks, everyone, so much for listening. Make sure you tell a friend, loved one, coworker. Go check out everything over at Ed's site, VinWiki. Have a good night, a good evening, wherever you are, whatever time it is there. You know, thanks so much for listening. And it's, you know, thanks for putting up with kind of the sporadic release schedule as of late. Should be back to a normal schedule here sooner-ish than later-ish. So hopefully we're back on track. Have a good one. Thanks, everyone, so much for listening. Have a good night.